Welcome to the Zerodha Educate podcast. My name is Prateek Singh, founder at LearnApp.com, a video education platform where you can learn investing from the brightest minds in the world. Do check out LearnApp.com. Today, we're going to talk about international investing. The growing popularity of behavioral finance in the last decade or so has shown that we investors suffer from a lot of biases. We do a lot of dumb things like overestimating our abilities when investing, falling in love with stories of stocks, markets, and even ignoring the facts. And my favorite, we love looking at stocks told by our best friend. But one bias that doesn't get much attention is the home country bias. It's the tendency of investors to invest all or most of their money in the country they live in. Think about it. Have you ever thought of investing abroad? Probably not, right? The Indian market is not truly representative of the global stock market. Let me tell you something cool. The All Country World Index, it's called ACWI, is an index that represents basically the entire world. Now, in this index, US dominates 50% weight and India is 1.1%. We may have a large population, but heck, our market cap is nowhere close to America. Meaning 99% of the investable opportunity is probably outside India. Now, investing abroad, I know, is really difficult. None of us know how to do it, but now we can, thanks to mutual funds, ETFs, direct investing, and even Zerodha is coming up with its own US investing platform soon. Today, I have Prateek Oswal, head of passive funds at Motilal Oswal Asset Management. He's going to talk about the importance of global investing. Motilal also runs the popular NASDAQ 100 ETF, a fund of fund that allows you to invest in NASDAQ. That's America's index. Thanks, Prateek, for doing this.
Thanks, Prateek. Good to be back and talking to you more about investing.
Always good, Prateek, talking to Prateek.
Yeah.
This time, let this Prateek play the devil's advocate, okay? So, international investing is new, right? So let me sort of start by doubting whether this works or not. Let me start with my first question. Let's start with the absolute basic. First, I'm an Indian. I've lived all my life. Why should I invest abroad?
I think it's important to understand that, when it comes to investing, it's important to sort of buy the right funds. It's important to invest in a very diversified sort of a way. You know, today the problem with investing is that it's very polarized in terms of stocks, but also in terms of funds. You know, you're looking at only, when people talk about investing in India, they talk about investing in, say, a mid-cap stock or a mid-cap fund of doing a certain strategy. Whereas, you know, I think what most people have realized is that investing, you know, the long-term returns of any customer over, say, 10 to 15 year period or more comes from the combination of assets and not really on what you buy, what you sell, all of that. So I think international investing, I think as a theme, should not be looked at as something that's which is a great investment by itself, but how it can be used to lower the volatility of your portfolio, how it can be used to add more diversification of portfolio, and how it can be used to sort of, you know, stabilize your long-term returns, in addition to also, obviously, dollar hedge investing.
Okay, dollar hedge investing, we'll talk about that in a bit. But before that, I have another question. Look at the data, let's say from 1996 to now, okay? And let's compare Nifty 50 and the NASDAQ 100. Both of them have done roughly the same. So that's good enough, right? Why should I take the headache of investing globally? What am I really missing?
Yeah, so let me give you an example, actually. So I went to the US to study around 10 years ago.
Right.
And I really pitched Indian equities very hard to a lot of my friends, a lot of my professors. And a lot of them actually did end up investing some money in Indian equities, direct stocks at that point of time, because obviously that was the flavor.
Okay.
And they did actually do pretty well over the last 10 years. So most of them have still held their funds, held their investments. But the problem is that, you know, they've lost all of it in dollar depreciation. So if you think about it, you know, if you'd invested in the Nifty 10 years ago, you would have around maybe doubled your money 2.5 times.
Okay.
But you've lost almost half of it or more than half of it because the dollar has depreciated a lot over the last 10 years. Right. So when I went to the US, I remember the dollar used to be like 40 rupees per dollar, and today it's almost 70.
Correct.
So which is almost a 60 or 70% depreciation over 10 years.
Which means Indian currency keeps depreciating against the dollar.
Absolutely.
And over a long term, that's the tendency, maybe because we import so much of oil.
Yeah. No, it's multiple factors. I think the biggest factor is inflation. You know, as long as inflation in India is higher than inflation in the US, you can expect the rupee to get weaker and weaker over time.
Yeah.
And if you've seen inflation in India, say 5 years ago, it used to be like close to like 10%.
Which will continue to happen.
Yeah. As long as we're a growth economy, you know, I think inflation at some level is good for the country.
Correct.
And as long as the inflation in India is higher than the inflation in the US, which is expected in the next, say, couple of decades also, you know, you can expect the dollar to depreciate, to continue to depreciate even over the next, say, 5 to 10 years.
So this is interesting, right, Pratik? You said that when you were in the US, you were evangelizing how great India is.
Yeah.
Now we're doing this podcast, you're telling me how great America is.
I know. Yeah, tables have turned. In fact, now I feel like, you know, investing abroad makes a lot more sense than someone coming to India. Obviously, even investing in India makes a lot of sense because, I mean, the growth opportunities in the country is phenomenal. So even after taking care of inflation, you still have companies that have done phenomenally well in India as well. But I think from an investing point of view, you know, what you're getting is through international investing is, you know, is access to some of the best assets in the world.
Yeah.
And you're also making that extra 3 to 5% every year because of the dollar and rupee parity.
Correct. I'll just stress on that a little bit more. So you said your professors, your friends in America who invested in India made money on an absolute basis,
yes,
but lost because of the currency exchange.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Which means if we were in India and we were investing abroad and it went up, just because the rupee is depreciating, you're actually making that 4-5%.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 I mean, yeah. So just to put it in very simple terms, you know, I can give you an example of a NASDAQ fund.
Done.
You know, so we launched a NASDAQ. I mean, we got the timing right. So that's just keep that in mind. But we launched our NASDAQ fund in 2011. And the fund, so the Nifty 50 since there has doubled. The NASDAQ fund, NASDAQ in the US has gone up 4 times. So 4X in the last 8 years. Our fund is up 6.5 times. So the extra 2.5X that you made on NASDAQ is because of rupee depreciation. So that's the opportunity that you're
looking
at.
That's a crazy alpha. Like, I don't think active fund can actually even do that.
Yeah, so we have investors who've invested us since like beginning, and they've actually outperformed the NASDAQ also, which I think is pretty cool. So basically, I think you're looking at that extra kicker because of dollar. And also, you think about it, you know, I think in terms of why is this important? Why do you have to get that extra money or whatever it is? It's because, you know, today a lot of our expenses are in dollars. Yeah? It's not in rupees anymore. You're buying an Apple iPhone. You know, you're buying Zara clothes, you're buying Nike shoes. You know, I would say anyone, and you're basically buying from e-commerce websites like Flipkart, which is owned by Walmart. And Amazon. So we all know that the iPhone today is, what, 1.5 lakh in India?
Yeah.
It used to be half the price, say, 5-6 years ago, and it's going to be more expensive later on because Apple doesn't care, you know. Apple will make money, will not sort of discount it based on the rupee.
Correct. And people will continue to take loans to buy those iPhones, guys.
Yeah.
That's going to continue to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're basically choosing between a Maruti and a Kia today, you know, so or a Hyundai today. So I think in addition to having that Maruti stock in your portfolio, which obviously is sound, it makes sense, it'll grow. But also, I think you also want to have that Hyundai or a Kia in your portfolio too, because that's where spending is headed slowly.
Right. It's also interesting, right? So now we're comparing global economy in India. Now, India, if you look at the top, say, 20 companies, top 30 companies, it's a lot of old world economy, right? Like, you don't have a lot of tech stocks, front-end tech stocks over there. It's all back-end outsourcing. So how does this fit in? Like, I mean, is this makeup going to change, or should I just invest in these top companies because they're outsourcing to the US?
Yeah.
Right. So why should I go ahead and just buy? I mean, for example, many companies may be back office to Amazon and Cisco, etc.
Yeah.
Why can't I just buy those companies instead of investing direct? Why should I invest directly in them?
Yeah. No, I think it's a great question. Why not just like, you know, because we all know that even Infosys, TCS, HCL Tech, their revenues are also dollar denominated.
Yeah.
So you can hedge, you can probably just buy them and sort of take advantage of the rupee or a dollar, the rupee depreciation, which I think is also a strategy that rewards fund managers use.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that, you know, in my, okay, so this is my opinion, these stocks are not really front-end, they're more back-end technology. They work for Fortune 500 companies that are not Amazon, not Apple, not Google, not the front-end tech guys.
Right.
So because of that, you know, I think they're more of sort of services and less front-end. And I think where the world is headed today is more towards changing the entire customer experience from front as well as the back end. So I think it's important to understand that you have to have some sort of, for diversification purposes, I think it's important to have both in your portfolio. I mean, today, if you look at Amazon, you know, I mean, they are sort of changing the way people buy and sell, you know, goods and services globally. And it's good to have some part of your portfolio in those sort of securities, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think we've covered everything about US versus India. If you could just sum this up, why should we think about investing abroad versus just India? And then we'll move on.
Okay. Okay, so just to summarize, I think you should do it because of asset allocation and diversification. So we actually didn't talk about this, but the goal about investing is, or at least to run a portfolio, is to reduce volatility. You know, and international investing, so we've done the numbers, that international funds and Indian funds are not correlated. By that, what I mean is that, you know, if Indian market goes up by 10%, the markets abroad might not go up by the same amount. So what you're doing is, if you're putting all your money in Indian funds or Indian stocks, then all your money is pretty volatile. So everything goes up together and all of it goes down together. Whereas the correlation of any, or at least our fund, vis-a-vis any index in India is actually 0.2%, which is crazy low, which is unbelievably low. So basically what I'm saying is, if the Indian markets fall by 10 to 15% today, the Nasdaq will, or at least historically, the Nasdaq has fallen by, say, maybe 2 to 3 or 3 to 4%. So I think that is really good, because, you know, at a portfolio level, you have to be able to, you know, not lose too much in the short term.
Yeah.
And that is where diversification is extremely important. So I think that's one point we didn't cover.
Correct.
The second is the dollar rupee hedge. So, you know, today our costs are in dollars. Like, a lot of our things we buy today are in dollars. We send our kids abroad for education, you know, so he or she will be paying the fees in dollars. So some part should be, you know, held for that. And thirdly, you know, also, I think you're buying the best quality assets. You know, Pratik, you mentioned that, you know, today India is only 1% of the global investing landscape. So it's good to have at least some part of your money in the other 99%. It shouldn't be too much, obviously. What I'm saying is, maybe have a 5 or 10% allocation.
Correct.
Because you want to sort of also be a part of the global growth, which is going to happen. And if it comes in the form of some of the best assets, you know, that's great.
Excellent. Perfect. So let's move on. So let's talk about the US markets in specific right now.
Okay.
So we've established the importance of global diversification. We understand that.
Okay.
Moreover, US markets are easier to access. So let's just continue talking about America, right? So the US has a bunch of indices. Basically, you have the S&P 500, which is hard to access. And then we have NASDAQ 100, which you guys have an ETF on. And then you have a Russell 1000. How does one go about deciding where to invest? I mean, there are three indices. Are they the same? What's the difference? Give me a quick overview.
Yeah, so let me talk about, let's talk about the two most popular indices. Actually, Dow Jones is the third most popular index.
You're right.
So I think in terms of the key differences, you're looking at NASDAQ, which is, I would say, the top 100 stocks that are non-financial in nature. So you're basically buying the top 100 stocks in the US that are listed in the US, which are non-financial based. So so that's a NASDAQ. The S&P 500 is a simple top 500 stocks in the US, so weighted by market cap. So the biggest companies, basically, that you're buying the top 500 biggest companies in the US. So the S&P 500 actually is the biggest fund in the world also. So it was launched some 45 or 50 years ago. 1970s, and it's today, you know, it's actually quite cool. The top three biggest funds in the world are all S&P 500.
Wow.
So it's the most popular index of all time. When people say the US, they say S&P 500. Yeah, so I think that's a pretty popular index. It's done pretty well, and also it's a one index where I think encapsulates the US economy. at least the large cap stocks. And the Dow Jones is also a popular index. It's also owned by, I think, the NASDAQ. And that's basically a little bit more, I would say, broad-based. And it's a little bit more towards a conservative sort of investor. So yeah. It has a lot of these companies like utilities and other things which are more sort of prone to give out dividends and less of capital appreciation. So it depends on what the investor wants. If the investor wants something that's a little bit more tech-heavy, then they, or a little bit more sort of fast-growing new-age industries, then right. NASDAQ is the one. If the investor just wants something that's like simple, broad-based, top 500 companies, they have the S&P. And the investor wants something that's a lot more dividend-oriented, a little bit more for income sort of generating, then the Dow Jones is something
that
the investors choose.
Perfect. I think that gives us a good idea of what these three indices do. Now, whether you talk to a person on the street or a billionaire who's buying a jet, if he's Indian and he's buying a jet, he's probably going to ask mileage kitna deti hai, right? So let me ask the aam aadmi question. Out of all these indices, what's been the historical returns of these indexes?
Yeah. So I just want to put out not like a warning thing, but just to tell investors that the reason why international investing is very popular today, or people are talking about it, is because of the returns. You know, I spoke about briefly the returns of NASDAQ, which are, I would say, above expectations.
Way above expectations.
And I truly feel that it's very simple for me to say stuff like, you know, you see the returns, this is where you're headed. But the truth is that, you know, investor buying the NASDAQ today will most probably not get the same returns in the
future.
You know, so I think investors need to understand that if you're investing for returns, then it's not a good enough reason. And you will be disappointed in the future because the probability of the same returns in the future are, I would say, lesser, I would say below average. But there are other reasons, as I mentioned, which is a much better figure. So I think in terms of returns, I think it's very similar to the philosophy behind the indexes. So the NASDAQ obviously is a little more tech-heavy. Growth industries, more about, so I think it's around 50-55% technology, and the rest will be sort of telecommunications or biotechnology or consumer durables, all of that. So it's a lot more sort of new age industries. The S&P 500 is obviously, I would say, much slightly not as high growth as NASDAQ, but the returns have been quite stellar over the last decade, and the Dow Jones obviously would be even lower than that. So I think it depends on the risk profile of the investor when he's looking at these indices. And that is what you should be looking at more than anything else.
I'll just summarize what you said. You said the NASDAQ has given phenomenal returns and you can see it, but most likely it's not going to, the same thing's not going to repeat.
So, investors should probably do, if they're looking at investing, I would say I think an SIP is a great way of building up that 5 to 10% exposure over the next, say, maybe 2 to 3 years.
And that element of timing is gone, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, even so the timing element is gone.
So that's nice. So why you should do that, again, it becomes risk diversification. And the second is that you're getting, assuming that the depreciation of the rupee continues, which it's been happening ever since I've been tracking it, you have that 4-5%, whatever that amount being given to you because you're buying dollars. Now, the next question is, what if the rupee appreciates?
Okay.
So, am I not taking additional risk? And in what situation can that actually happen?
I mean, it could happen. So, the rupee could appreciate over the next 10 years. No one knows. I mean, nobody can predict that. But if it does happen, then obviously it will eat into your returns. So, if, say, a rupee appreciates by 2 to 3% every year. And I would say most guys who provide or have index or have international funds, AMCs don't really, or at least from on my... What I believe is that most of them don't hedge currency. So you will lose that amount if it appreciates every year. But the expectations of that happening are...
But that has to be a macro trend, right? Like suddenly, like it's been depreciating for so long and suddenly it turns around.
Yeah.
It has to be something crazy India's doing for that
macro
trend.
Yeah, and honestly, it will probably... I would say it's not good because India wants to be a more export-oriented country. So we are saying made in India... And I think as an export-oriented company, you know, appreciation is not a good thing because and the reason why China has done well is because they've kept their currency stable.
Yeah.
So I think now they're not, but they used to keep it stable for a very long
time. Let's imagine that in some case that the rupee does start appreciating.
Okay.
What can I do as an investor? That's the first question. Second, if that happens, should I even start to speculate and try to time it and do something to protect myself for this hedge? What should I do?
I mean, honestly, these things cannot be protected, cannot be predicted. And I think the guys who do end up predicting a lot, and in most cases end up being wrong.
Yeah.
So what I would suggest is not do anything. And I think even though it will appreciate, it'll probably be a short-term phenomena. Mm. But I think even though it will sort of negatively impact your portfolio, I think the benefits of diversification through international funds outweigh that, like, by a huge margin. So as long as you're buying the right assets, as long as you're sort of making sure that you're buying some of the biggest and the best businesses in the world, you should be fine.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. I think we overestimate what our short-term perception of things can be and underestimate how things can be the same over long periods of time. Like, doing simple things actually works.
Yes.
So let's take a slight detour and move towards geopolitics.
Okay.
So we're living through an interesting time over the last few years. Like, globalization is actually on a decline. So there are trade tensions across the world. There are countries which are closing their borders. So how do you see this playing out? And how does this translate to investment risk?
I think, it's a good question. But this may or may not be a long-term trend. You know, so if you look at India today, actually India is a lot more global country than it was, say, 5 or 10 or 15 years ago. So I think it's important to understand, to sort of follow the long-term trend, which is globalization. Yes, there are countries who are closing borders. There are sort of issues happening globally, which may or may not be good. But I think it doesn't have to do anything with investing. The way I see it, India is a lot more global today, number one. And number two, I think if you look at Indian companies today, so one big risk. So let me play it backwards. Today, an Indian investor is only buying Indian securities. Are Indian companies or are Indian stocks adaptive, or are they good enough to survive for the next 15, 20, 25, 30 years? A lot of them will, but a lot of them will become global companies.
Yeah.
So today, I know I pointed this out earlier that, today a Maruti is not competing with a Tata. The Maruti is competing with a Kia.
Yeah.
So the Indian businesses need to fight local competition as well as global competition. In fact, global competition is coming with a lot more force, because the problem is that we made ourselves, or the campaign about making India and India growth story
has now opened us up
to a lot of foreign players wanted to come in.
Yeah, which is a great thing for the country.
Which is great, yeah. Absolutely. The amount of investing money is coming, the amount of jobs, all that is great. But I think it keeps a lot of our listed stocks, in some long-term risk of survival, which is why I think international investing is great, number one. Number two, I think the risk that people should be talking about is today a lot of startups are doing pretty well. So I think there's a lot of disruption coming from the bottom.
Yeah.
So failure to adapt is something that, I would really, I think international investing is a good way of hedging that, failure to adapt. For big companies, and also I think there's disruption coming from the top, which is the Netflixes and the Google and stuff like that. So I think it's good to sort of spread out your risk in multiple buckets, which I think is not really which I think is not something that investors should only hold.
Excellent. So basically, diversify, and it's all okay.
Yeah.
And coming to the globalization decline, you basically said it's a short-term phenomenon and it's something that shouldn't really matter to investors, right?
I mean, politics generally remains short-term,
yeah.
Because the incentives are very short-term. Whereas
Correct.
Investing, I think the incentives, or at least so far what has played out, that I think people who have invested for long-term, or I think getting rich slow is what's worked for, I would say, most people.
That's
You had Warren Buffett, who's gone through like a couple of world wars.
Exactly.
The oil crisis, gone through like stuff that is like, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40
and
times.
And he drank
worse.
Coke all the way through it, yeah. Man, and it worked. And it worked.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the biggest risk is, I would say, not taking risk. And I think people shouldn't be affected by short-termism. And should look at it as more of an opportunity to create wealth for their families and the kids and all of that.
You know, Pratik, I've met a lot of investors because of the nature of LearnApp. Like, we meet a lot of people, like, yeah, including people like you and people who actually manage money, yeah, and who've made it over long term. And basically, this is a good summary of what you're saying. Like, what you're saying is, if you believe a theme, hold on to it for as long as possible. Everything else is a distraction.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially in today's world, you know, I think distraction is the name of the game.
Correct.
You know, so I think it's very easy to be distracted. You know, it's easy to...
And focus is rare.
Focus is rare, absolutely. You have CNBC, you have so many guys who are on Twitter, you know, about, like, you know, spreading rumors, spreading false, all of that. So I think getting rich slow has become harder than it used to be, yeah, back in the day, where I think you had to go. So I remember, like, 20 or 30 years ago when this company started, I think they used to go, like, you know, by bike to the stock exchange and, like, you know, buy these annual reports and come back home and read them. You know, whereas today, you know, you have the analytics, you have everything on a tip of a finger. So I think being non-reactive is a lot harder today than it used to be.
And maybe that's the edge.
And that's the enemy. And that's the edge, exactly.
And that's the edge.
Yeah, if everyone's doing it, then you're probably not going to do well. But if a few people are sort of, you know, being patient and just waiting for things to just play out the way they're supposed to, yeah, you'll be fine.
Guys, I hope you're taking notes. This was good gyan here. Yeah. Okay, let's move towards global valuations. Now, we have something called the CAPE ratio, which is basically a fancy way of a long-term earnings per share metric. Now, if you look at that ratio in the US, it's about 30 and India is about 22. What does this mean? Does it mean that US is overvalued?
So, the US is, I mean, depends on what you're looking at. The US is a very broad country, but let me talk about how the country has actually benefited over the last 10 years.
Yeah. You
know, so valuations are a metric of growth as well.
Yes.
So if you look at the long-term sort of averages, the US, so in India, I mean, let's just do a simple comparison. The Nifty 50, you know, it is expensive. You know, it is expensive. The PE.
You mean right now?
Right now.
Like
right
2020 February.
Yeah, yeah.
March.
So right now it is expensive. The PE ratios are, which is price to earnings, which is basically market cap over the profits of these companies, are relatively higher than
it's
average.
Almost equal than 2008, actually.
Yeah, I mean
the top, the
tip. That, I mean, maybe yes, but yeah. So I think the markets, and I think the reason why PE is expensive is because the value of these businesses have increased, but the earnings haven't caught up.
Right.
So PE is a function of earnings as well as value.
Right.
So value has gone up, earnings haven't caught up. Let's look at the US. Earnings have caught up. So the PE ratio is, yes, it's a little bit high, but...
The
earnings are catching up in a big way. You're still looking at, so for example, the NASDAQ. It's still, I would say, on average with historical PE. And the reason why the PE is high is because you're looking at growth stocks.
And actually, you're right. If you look at the best growth stocks in the past, like the old ones, I'm talking about the Cisco, the Amazon,
yeah,
they were always trading very high PE.
Very high PEs.
Because they had growth.
Yes.
So that's not always a bad thing.
Yes, exactly. So you're buying high growth companies. So yes, PEs will be expensive, number one. And number two, you have to look at under other fundamentals of the index. So the ROEs have improved by 5 to 6%. Over the last 10 years.
Overall?
Yes, of the entire index.
Isn't that really high?
That is very high. That is really good. So I think the companies are making a lot more money today than they used to, say 10 years ago. And also the margins of companies. You know, we thought that, you know, I think the margins in the US are lower than the margins in India, but actually they've actually expanded. So all these guys, well, especially the top 10, 15 stocks, you know, make a lot of sort of cash flow.
Right.
And I think because of that, margins are also... So I think if you factor in the margins, if you factor in ROEs, it is still a good time to enter. Having said that, you know, obviously, as I said, you know, I think I would prefer doing SIPs than doing a huge...
Correct, because
lump sum.
No one really knows the timing.
No one really knows
no
the
one
timing.
Knows that,
I mean, I'll give you an example from my own life. When I was managing money in the US in 2017... You know, the NASDAQ, I remember, and this was like 3 years ago. Yeah, 3 years ago, almost. The NASDAQ was up, I would say, 30% that year. And
in a single year?
In a single year. I mean, last year was 40%.
That's
last 12 months.
Oh, that's nuts.
Yeah, it's been...
See, I don't even look at US markets. You see, I should be surprised at this. I'm hosting this session.
Yeah, so the NASDAQ was up some 30-odd percent. And a lot of my end customers were holding a lot of cash. And which is good for me because, so in my previous company, I was selling something that hedges downside protection.
Okay.
So we ended up doing a lot of sales because people were risk averse. But I mean, if you and this was 3 years ago, and Nasdaq has probably doubled since then.
Right.
So so I think you have to understand that, you know, I think no one knows where the future is headed. You know, it might, but it's important to have some part of your portion, at least like a small part in these indexes.
I think the same thing will be applied to what you just said to what my follow-up thing was. I was thinking that most of the index which has moved up, right, it's happened because of the FANGs.
Yes.
So the Facebook, the Amazon, Netflix, Google, the most bought stocks, like even if you look at Robinhood,
yeah,
which is a really famous brokerage house in the US.
Yes.
Most of those guys have bought FANG stocks.
Yes.
Right. So is it just because of these four stocks that the entire index looks good?
Yes. I mean, so I'll be honest. Yes. Last few months, these five or six stocks have really sort of pulled up. I think all of them are now above $1 trillion in market caps.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, at least the last two or three years, have done phenomenally well. But, you know, you have to understand that even the earnings have been incredible. And
so it's not like there's a divergence between the earnings and the growth.
No, in fact, the earnings have been really great. They're all growing 30, 40, 50% in earnings every year. Profitability is up. And also, even though they're headquartered in the US, you know, I would say over 50 or 60% of their incremental revenue and profits are coming from their operations worldwide. So, you know, even though you're buying a US company, you're actually indirectly buying global growth. You know, so the US operations of, say, a Google would probably make, say, 15-20% growth every year.
Yeah.
But the actual 30-40-50% what they're posting is coming from their operations internationally.
Which is true. Like, if you think
about
it.
Yeah, it is an international index.
I mean, think about the last 4-5 years, right, Prateek? Yeah. Like, all of us use a Facebook product, which could be a WhatsApp or whatever. We use Amazon. We use Netflix. We use Google, probably their phones, or G Suite, like our company does.
Yeah.
So we're all actually customers to this. It's not that international after all, right? We are customers of them every single day. So if you consider a blue chip stock, why not this?
Exactly, yeah. So we are customers. And, you know, there was this gentleman called Peter Lynch who written this very good book called Common Stocks, Uncommon Profits, where he's talked about, you know, you should actually end up buying a lot of companies that you see or use on a daily basis.
Yes.
Or companies that you see other people using and reusing and all of that. And I think international stocks sort of play that criteria pretty well.
Correct.
You know, so we all of us, you know, I mean, I have my phone, my laptop, it's all these companies that I'm using. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's good that at least you're putting your money where your spending is.
We're living in a very interesting time, Prateek. I don't think my father could have even thought about this. One, he didn't have the extra cash to put it up.
Yeah.
Second, there were no mutual funds or any way to directly invest, even direct stocks, right?
Yeah.
There's no way to do that.
Yeah.
So I think we're the first generation to even consider this as a possibility, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, I mean, it's good that people have options today. And you have multiple options, you know. So mutual funds is not the only option.
Correct.
A lot of people do it through LRS.
What is that?
So it's called the Liberalized Remittance Scheme, where every investor in India can put up to 250K every year, basically abroad. So that is something which is increasingly becoming popular.
Which is a lot. Which is like 7 2s are what, 2 crores almost.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's so that's a yearly. So I think it that is also an option that investors have.
And that's
today.
Direct stocks. You can put it in a foreign brokerage
account.
And
no problem. Yeah. I mean, there are certain administrative paperwork that obviously you have to do. Because, I mean, money coming into India is not a problem.
Yeah, going out is a big problem.
Out is where, because obviously looking at a currency situation, you know, the government wants, I mean, to minimize as much outflows as possible.
Yeah.
So I think there are some administrative sort of stuff that you have to do, but it also one more option that investors have.
Nice. I'm going to move on coast to a new topic again. Let's talk about NASDAQ 100 specifically.
Okay.
Okay. Now, again, I'm going to be a little devil's advocate over here just for this question. So let's talk about the NASDAQ 100 ETF. Now, it tracks, obviously, the NASDAQ 100 index. Now, the thing about this index is, and you mentioned this earlier, 40% is Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, which is Google, which is tech, right? And Facebook, if you include that, it's about 46-47%.
Yes.
Now, this is really tech heavy, and all of these tech stocks have run up a lot. Do I need to be worried as an investor because it's so much focused on tech?
Yeah. Well, tech is the theme of today. So I think tech disruption is real. We have to accept it that, you know, in say 5 or 10 years time, every company will have to become a tech company. Otherwise, they'll have a huge problem in sort of becoming, being relevant.
Yeah.
So I think technology is not really a fad. I feel like it's a trend.
Yeah.
And as companies get bigger and bigger, it's more important for them to increasingly adopt technology. So I think tech heavy, yes. I think the Nasdaq specifically, yes, you know, it is quite tech heavy. I would say, as you said, 30-40% is in tech stocks, but that's actually true of any index today, you know. So people ask me this question that the top 10 stocks, so the 10% of Nasdaq is, or the 10 stocks have 50% weightage in the Nasdaq, which is quite high.
Yeah.
But if you look at any index, you know, it's the same numbers. So the S&P 500. In fact, the S&P 500 is even more polarized, you know, so you have, which is like the most important index in the world, the top 10%, which is top 50 stocks, is about, I would say, 60 or 65% of the index, and it's the same for Indian stocks. So I think, there is, it is real that, you know, these indexes are a little bit top heavy, but having said that, you know, I am looking at investors who are want to invest for a very long time.
Of course.
And
of course,
if you're looking at that philosophy, then you shouldn't be worried because these things normalize over time.
But if you're thinking like that, Prateek, why did you choose to launch the Nasdaq ETF? Why didn't you launch the S&P 500, the Russell 1000, which is a little more diversified, right? Why did you choose...
No, the S&P 500 is not as diversified as Nasdaq. So the S&P 500 actually it's less diversified than the Nasdaq because the top 50... is still obviously it's diversified in terms of number of stocks in our portfolio.
Yeah.
But on concentration basis, you're still having top 50 stocks.
Even sector allocation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the sector allocation probably in S&P is different than the Nasdaq.
Yes, it is. But also, yeah, so I agree. But the idea behind Nasdaq is to buy the world's most like sort of new age industries, you know. So the reason why Nasdaq has done well is because the underlying stocks have done well.
Yeah.
And that theme, that technology theme has played out pretty well.
Yeah, the fangs were sharp this time.
Yeah, the fangs have done well. But I mean, having said that, you know, this is the index. Hmm. So you're not buying a few stocks. No. So you're buying 100 stocks.
Yes.
Plus you're buying the top 100 stocks. You're not buying tech stocks. So for example, you know, I gave this example in my previous podcast that the Nifty 50, 15 years ago, used to be industrials, oil and gas, utilities. Today it's financial services.
Yeah.
Tomorrow it might be something else. Yeah. So when you're buying index, you're not buying tech. You're not buying technology. You're buying the top 100 stocks, regardless of what they'll be. So maybe, I don't know, and maybe in 10 years' time, you know, the media will become a lot bigger than tech. Who
and
knows?
Nasdaq will probably
be full of media stocks. You know, yeah. Who knows? Or consumer media durables. Yeah, media or consumer durables, whatever it is.
Knows?
Or maybe, you know, I mean, because if the trend plays out over the next 10 years, then every single stock will become a tech company. So there goes your diversification. So I mean, I think people need to understand that you're buying top 100 stocks, non-financial stocks, you know, buying tech companies.
That's nice.
And if you're invested for a long time, then
that's all that matters.
Then the index will adapt.
But are you going to launch more global funds?
Yes, yeah. So we are looking at international funds. This year we are looking to launch another diversified fund. So we are looking at the S&P 500. So that is something which we are trying. So I can't confirm. But then we're also looking at a global fund. So, but we want to keep it very, very simple. So we're looking at just purely indexes.
Yeah. So now let's come back home here. You guys launched ETF in what, 2011, I think, your first ETF.
Yeah.
And so, any interesting observations of the ETF kinds of investors versus the other kind of investors in their behavior?
You mean to say,
are they more long term oriented generally, or how are these investors generally behaving?
I think so. It's been one way, I'll be honest. So I think most of our investors have created wealth month over month, year over year. So so far they've been pretty long term investors. And the beauty about passive or about indexing as a investing methodology is that you don't really underperform the index.
Yeah, you are the index.
Yeah, you are the index. So there's no really need to churn your portfolio ever. So. I think that is one big reason to why people end up sticking to these things for a much longer time period, because there's no reason to sort of move around and sell this, buy something else, all of that.
Yeah, correct.
So long-term investing, what I talked about, is relatively less complicated, a little bit easier with index funds or ETFs that are passively managed. There are actively managed ETFs too.
Yeah.
But I think I'm talking about the passively managed ones.
I mean, clearly ETF is doing well. That's why you're doing different kinds of ETFs, which is the global ETF. So that's why I asked that question. But someone who's come this far, and I said this in our last podcast as well, congratulations to you. He's probably thinking now portfolio allocation, right?
Yes.
So let's suppose someone says, okay, NASDAQ, interesting. If someone says, okay, fine, I want global exposure, but he's very young versus okay. someone who's nearing retirement.
Okay.
Give me an allocation strategy.
I wouldn't ask that question. Okay. I would go about asking what are the person's goals. Let me give an example. Someone who's 25 might have to buy a house in 5 years' time.
Yes.
Whereas someone who's retired might have is saving for his grandkids.
Okay.
You know, he has a big house. He has, I mean, huge house. He has a big bank account. He's saving for his grandkids, so he can probably be a lot more aggressive than someone who's 25. So I think it depends on a lot depends on that.
And true, if he wants regular income, then probably this isn't the product for him at all.
Yeah, exactly. So this is more of a no. I mean, I would say every investor should have some allocation to international. Mm. So I think it depends on what and if you're holding, say, a 5 or 10% stake, sort of 5 or 10% allocation, then I think a little bit more risky is fine. There are other low risk options. I mean, there are a bunch of international funds today in India, including indexes. So there are a lot of options to investors.
Yeah.
So I think, but I would say look at the risk profile of the fund as opposed to the returns that a fund is driven.
Correct. I think the way that they should think is just this is equity, whether it's India or abroad.
Yeah.
And it's just another way to diversify within equity. So equity is always a long-term thing, right? So whether they're doing it for retirement or for whatever, they should think 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Otherwise, don't think about it at all.
Yeah, exactly. So you should ideally have a long-term vision. And if you are doing a short-term sort of a thing, then maybe have a huge allocation to debt. You know, suppose you have a goal coming in 3 years' time. Then
yes.
maybe have 70-80% in debt, which you know will amount to some amount, something. And then maybe you can add like maybe a 10 or 20% in equity kicker.
And that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
So since we recorded the conversation on importance of global diversification, Motilal has launched the Motilal Oswal S&P 500 Index Fund. So we naturally caught up at Prateek again to talk specifically about this new fund and how it's different from the NASDAQ 100 and how you can use it in the portfolio, etc. You know, since we recorded this podcast, Prateek and the guys at Motilal got the approval to launch the S&P 500 Index Funds. So this is pretty cool because the S&P 500 has actually performed really well over the last decade. So we decided to catch up with Prateek again and understand more about the fund. So please enjoy my extended conversation with Prateek Oswal and the Motilal Oswal S&P 500 Fund Special. So Prateek, thanks for doing this on such a short notice.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for having me again.
Actually, we're lucky we have lockdown, so I could catch you. Otherwise, you're always so busy. So.
yeah. No, honestly, I think I've got used to Zoom. So I think it's a good platform. The only problem is that, you know, I haven't really cut my hair in a month's time. So I think Zoom is also not turning out to be the best medium.
Sure. Yeah. So let's begin. So for the lay investor, Prateek, what is the Motilal S&P 500 fund? What does it track? Give me some details.
Yeah, so just very broadly, you know, the S&P 500 is actually a very, I would say, I mean, at least for me personally, it's a very historic thing because it was the first ever passive fund launch in the world. You know, this was in 1975. Hmm. And it was launched by this guy called Jack Bogle, who was the founder of this mutual fund company called Vanguard.
Yeah.
Which is now the biggest mutual fund in the world. You know, so I think it's a very historic fund because the entire sort of passivization happened with this fund. You know, the fund has now been around for almost 50 to 60 years. You know, so I think, and when I would say 60 to 70% of the funds have shut down, you know, this is now becoming the world's largest fund today. So I think not only has it survived, it's also thrived in a very big way.
Yeah.
So just to give you some numbers, if you look at how big the S&P 500 is, you have almost $10 trillion worth of assets that is either managed or benchmarked to this fund. So, you know, so just to give you some analogy, the Indian, India's GDP is around $3.5 trillion. So you're looking at one fund that has, you know,
That is, I think, three times, you know, India's GDP in terms of number of assets benchmarks. I think it's a very important fund. You know, if someone asks anyone, how is the US economy doing? People talk about the S&P 500. So it's the single best gauge of the US economy. And I think it's become more and having had experience of managing money for people in the US, you know, I've seen hundreds of portfolios and not one of them did I see which I didn't have S&P 500. So it's become a bit of a default fund in people's portfolios.
That's really interesting. You know, when the first time you hear S&P 500, you think, oh, American companies from America. But the interesting thing is that 40% of the sales of these S&P 500 companies, 40% comes from all over the world. So am I really getting global exposure and not just investing in, say, the American economy?
Yeah, exactly. So in fact, you know, if you look at the S&P 500, so as you said, you know, 40% of the sales of the companies in the S&P 500 are coming from their operations overseas. And in fact, you know, if you see some of the top companies, you know, their US operations are quite steady, you know, 5, 10, 15% growth. But a lot of their exponential growth, you know, is coming from their operations in, say, India, emerging markets, other parts of the world. So actually, you know, what you're getting is some of the best brands and a lot of their exponential growth coming from their operations worldwide. So actually, the way I would recognize it is, even though it's listed in the US, you know, it is actually a pretty global fund.
Yeah, I think that makes it even more attractive, because I think India, we talked about this before, right, Prithik? Home country bias. People don't think that they should invest in other countries.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. You know, so if you look at average Indian, including, I mean, I think my portfolio or most people's portfolio today, you know, so the Indian, so if you see India's GDP as compared to world standards, we are at 3% of global GDP. You know, so all our investments is put in this 3%, whereas, you know, we could have access to 97% of the global GDP, which we're not investing in. So, yeah. You know, the S&P 500 gives you access to that 20-25% of global GDP. So you're basically getting the world's fastest economy, which is India, combined with the world's biggest economy, which is the US. So it makes your portfolio, I would say, in line with where the world is evolving.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, coming back to your original point of when you said Vanguard, the original index fund creator, right? So this index fund you're launching is a pure index fund. It's not a fund of funds. So Yes. You could have done that, right? You could have just made a fund of funds and maybe the money travels through you and goes straight to a Vanguard S&P 500, which charges really low. Why didn't you do a fund of funds instead?
Yeah, so the charges wouldn't have, I would say, impacted as much, I'll be honest, number one. But that's one of the main reason to why we did it, you know. So philosophically, you know, I think as someone who is launching a passive fund, you know, we want to take out as much risk as possible. You know, that's my, so my job is to not deliver return, but to manage risk for the customer.
Right.
You know, and if you look at the S&P 500, say if I come to a feeder fund, then, you know, I have a lot of AMC risk. You know, so if you see today in the US, a lot of AMCs are sort of closing down or consolidating and all of that. You know, so I think, and if you're looking at something which will last you 10, 20, 30, 40 years, hopefully for an investor, I think it makes sense to go directly to the stocks. You know, so which is why I think, you know, we didn't go for the feeder fund route. The cost would have been pretty much the same. So then that is not an issue. And second is, I think, you know, if you look at your statement today, you know, for a S&P 500 index fund, it's good to see that you're holding some of the best assets. You can see names of all these companies in your statement. So I think that is also pretty like a power factor. Plus, we've already have experience managing the Nasdaq fund. We've been doing it for almost 9 years' time. So I think the idea is to just replicate that strategy out here.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that totally makes sense, but I had to ask you that question. So another thing that is very obvious right now, we're all at our homes, our hair is overgrown, the barber's not there. We're all, at least I am washing dishes at home. So isn't this a bad time to launch this? Also, the S&P is down 13%.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Things might get worse in the future, right?
Yes. So I think there's a saying that when others are fearful, you should be greedy, and you should be greedy when others are fearful. This is by Warren Buffett. And so ideally, you know, I think if you look at the S&P, we were actually supposed to launch this fund in February.
Right.
You know, and we got delays in terms of approvals, and now we're able to launch the same fund when the markets are down 20-30%.
Everything's relative.
Yeah. So, and you know, I think, I mean, I can obviously talk about this for a very long time, but to, you know, put it very succinctly, I think, you know, it's most investors today have a 0% exposure to foreign equities. You know, so what I would say is to have a minimum of 5 to 10% sort of exposure to foreign securities, but to build it over the next 6 to 12 months time. You know, so that is a sound strategy, because what that does is you're actually, you know, even though the markets, I mean, obviously no one knows where the markets will go, you know, no one can predict, it's impossible. But, you know, I think it's good that you're getting assets at, I think, cheap. If you look at the valuations today, you know, the S&P 500 is below long-term averages. So you're getting it at below sort of long-term average. And if you compare the fundamentals of these companies, you know, so just to put it very short, you know, this crisis, you know, there was no leverage and P ratios were, I would say, at average. The last crisis, which is the, I would say, the financial crisis, you know, the companies were leveraged and the P ratios are very high. And earnings were not there. The dot-com boom, the P ratios were, I would say, 5 times where they are today.
Yep.
And there was no earnings. So I think the companies themselves are very different fundamentally. You know, you're looking at earnings that have been so powerful. So I really think, you know, this is a good time to at least start building a portfolio and having a 5 to 10% allocation over time.
Correct. And I think the entire idea of this is to like play the cycle, right? And if a cycle is 7 to 10 years long, and as you said, we're below the long-term averages, that's what
you're saying. Exactly. So the guys who participate in today's markets are the guys who are going to win over the long term, you know? So I think, in real life, this is an analogy, you know, you shouldn't be scared of short-term failures, you know, and even the stock market, you shouldn't be scared of short-term failures. You know, you should be looking at things from a long-term perspective. So I think anyone participating today will be happy over the long term. In terms of this lockdown, you know, you asked me the question, you know, we were very lucky because, you know, we've been planning this launch for a while. So, you know, and kudos to the entire Motilal Oswal team, you know, so I think I'm more of a front of this, but you know, there's hundreds of people working the back end, making sure that our IT, our operations, you know, transaction processing, banks and all that are working fine. So I think that is what's allowed us to, you know, really go ahead and launch this NFO in this difficult time period. And the idea is to, you know, make this available to investors as soon as possible. So,
Yeah, perfect. I wanted to talk about portfolio allocation, right? So when we talk about general portfolio allocation, we say, hey, look at debt, look at equity, look at gold maybe. And the reason for that is because they have low correlation amongst each other, right?
Right.
Now, within equity, I understand that there's low correlation if you diversify globally in equity. So Nifty, S&P 500, and NASDAQ 100. What's the correlation between these three indices?
Yeah, so in any Indian index will have a correlation of around 80 to 90%. So it's pretty high. And that is evident, you know, when you saw the, so if you saw the fall, I think 1 or 2 months ago, you know, regardless if you held a large cap fund or a mid cap fund or a small cap fund, everything is down 30%. You know, so the correlation is very high. Whereas in international funds, what we've seen is that the correlation between the NASDAQ and S&P versus Indian indices is less than 0.15,
wow,
which is 15%, you know, versus 80%. So I think what this does is that, you know, as a portfolio level, you're really protecting yourself from, you know, any sort of number one, local risk, and number two, dollar risk. And number three, also, you know, I think you're protecting your portfolio by giving it a bit of downside protection and also lowering the volatility of the portfolio in a big way. So I think in terms of asset allocation, you know, I think international equity should definitely be in a portfolio. I think investors, yes, are lured by the returns that have been generated by the NASDAQ and S&P. But what I would plead investors is to, you know, look beyond returns, you know, look at the risk, look at the value that it can provide at the portfolio level, and which will help you stick to this portfolio for a long time.
I saw a really startling number on your website. Since 2010, the Nifty 500 in dollar terms has given a negative return, and the S&P 500 has returned a different number. So can you tell me about those numbers and what it means for the average or the average?
Yes. So this was, I think, post the crash, but, you know, forget the crash. If you would, if you're invested. So just to give an analogy, if a friend of mine, say in the US, invested in the Nifty 50 or Nifty 500, you know, say 10 years ago, he would have made around 0.8% CAGR over the last 10 years.
Wow.
Versus an Indian investor investing the same asset would have made 10 to 12%. So that is how much the dollar has worked against us, you know. And imagine, and for an Indian investor, it's exactly the opposite experience, you know, because if he, you know, so for example, the S&P has delivered around 10 to 11% CAGR. But if you convert that in rupees, you're looking at an 18, 19% CAGR over the last 10 years.
So it's worked in our favor.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, people used to talk about the, I would say, I mean, India growth story 10 years ago, but actually, you know, I think the guys who have benefited are the ones who've actually, you know, sent money abroad or invested abroad in these indexes. So I think, and I do feel like, you know, 3-5% depreciation per year is what investors should account for, because that is just the long-term trend and what we think will happen over the next few years. So I think, you know, the value proposition of this fund extends beyond portfolios. It also helps you manage your dollar risk, because, you know, we spoke about this in the podcast, you know, your expenditure today increasingly is in dollar terms, in dollar assets. So, yeah.
Right. So I'm just trying to compare. We just talked about S&P 500, right? And how it was minus 0.82%.
Yes, yeah. Post the fall.
Yeah. So let's compare that with NASDAQ 100, right? Whether it's an ETF or a mutual fund, it's returned 15%. That's plus 15%. So isn't NASDAQ 100 a better option to diversify? I mean, why should we look at S&P 500?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a good question. So, you know, international diversification means diverse. So if you look at the NASDAQ fund, you know, we've been managing for a long time. And if you look at the components of the NASDAQ fund, the reason why it's delivered such insane returns, you know, you're looking at 20 to 25% CAGR. You know, our fund has gone up 7 times in the last, say, 9 years, which is crazy. The reason why it's happened is because the technology sector has really, really sort of, you know, taken the NASDAQ and, you know, moved forward. So if you look at the tech stocks, the weightages of tech sector, technology sector is close to 47-48% NASDAQ. You know, so I think if someone is taking a bet on, say, technology and looking at, so it is more of a international technology diversification, whereas the S&P 500 is actually a pure play international diversification. You know, the S&P, so you're getting 80% of the US market cap, you know, whereas the NASDAQ, it's close to 30%. So I would say, you know, I think, yes, I do agree that NASDAQ is technology is going to play as important a role in the future than it has in the past. So in terms of asset allocation, you know, my personal preference would be a 50-50, you know, because if you put everything in NASDAQ, then you're basically taking a lot of sector concentration risk, which is something you don't want to do if you're looking for diversification. So I think a pure play diversification would be NASDAQ, would be S&P 500. But yes, I agree. I think if someone is looking to take a bet on technology, then NASDAQ is a better bet. But I would say have both.
Can you say that again? I would say
you should have both.
Excellent. Excellent. So this is one thing I have to ask, like index funds are known for low costs usually. People are understanding what costs it takes, right? When you invest in an index fund, mutual fund. So where are you guys planning to place this fund? Is there a price, a ballpark number?
Yes. So the total expense ratio of this fund will be 1%, but the direct plan would be 0.5%. So it becomes one of the cheapest funds out there in terms of international diversification. So in 0.5%, you're getting access to, and the minimum ticket size is, I think, 500 rupees. So in 500 rupees, you're getting access to 500 largest companies, including marquee names, right? I mean, you know, I'll be honest, if you show any of your listeners logos of the top 500 US companies versus the top 500 Indian companies, they'll probably relate to the top 500 companies in the US a lot more.
True.
We do see them and use them on a daily basis. So I think brand recollection is very high. Number one. Number two, and this is a common question I get, you know, should I active versus passive for internationals? You know, for Indian markets, I agree. You know, I think you should have both, or, you know, or depending on your strategy. But for internationals, you know, what we've seen is that, you know, passive has now become a little bit of a default structure. Number one. Number two, you know, if you look at data, you know, 90% of the active funds are now underperforming the benchmarks, the index. So I think, you know, and as we all know how difficult it was to find a fund manager in India, finding a fund manager abroad is even harder.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, keep it simple, you know, buy the index and hopefully it will last you a very long time. S&P is around for 60 years.
Excellent, Prateek. That was fun. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, this was fun, and look forward to having more discussions with you. Thank you, Prateek.
Absolutely. Thank you. This conversation is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all the scheme-related documents carefully. Please consult your financial advisor before making any investments.